Accession number 4630, Reel 4.
Colonel Thomas, Reel 4.
Of course, one reads today of the horrific conditions in the Japanese PW camps, and no doubt they existed, and the conditions generally were horrific. But in the midst of it all, these sort of situations where the British soldier was sort of completely in command of affairs and would insult the commandant and decry the whole of the Japanese system and everything and make the most impudent remarks and yet get away with it. Absolutely incredible, the whole thing.
Did your treatment vary according to how the war was going, as far as you could detect?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. The viewing the Japanese army from down below, that commandant was absolutely all-powerful. It's an incredible thing about the Japanese army living with them. The orderly officer, for instance, wore a sash every day, and he seemed to be able to overpower or, what shall I say, countermand even the commandant's instructions. He wore the sash of the emperor. And the commandant was in charge, and the war, he obviously was getting news. They didn't disclose any to us, as I said earlier, but it all went over the top of his head anyway, and he was firmly convinced, or he appeared to be, just as we were convinced that we were going to get out of it, he was convinced that we were there forever.
You've mentioned collaboration. What forms did this collaboration take?
Well, you know, you've got chaps there, and there's 15 or 16 of you bedded down, and the sentries come along and they do this and they do one thing and another, and then somebody gets a bit Barbary, and a PW would get Barbary and rebel and begin to hit back a bit, and you would hear the the usual chap would say, oh, don't do that or something, you mustn't do that or something, and of course the sentry could see that we were divided, and these chaps were always there to take the Japanese point of view and add things, got to the very end as far as we were concerned. I'm positive that these chaps would have even gone over. It was as simple as that. This is only a guess, but their very actions in situations where it came to a showdown with the Japanese, they were not entirely on our side. There were these people about, regrettably, and I should think out of about 200, we had three, I should think, quite definitely, who would have collaborated at the drop of a hat. And they were known, completely known. The troops knew them, knew who they were. But they didn't produce any evidence that one could have convicted them on or even charged them with afterwards. They were just cooperators. I mean, in the main, the British Tommy, once he was organized, was an absolute non-cooperator. But these two or three were cooperators.
What do you think their motives were for taking this attitude?
I don't know. That's a good question, because I tried to get to the bottom of the mind of one of them, who I'm convinced definitely of the three that I have in mind in our camp anyway, would have probably been the worst one. But he had he'd never been overseas before. He didn't appreciate how the Oriental mind worked, or what, or the way the Orientals would have twisted and turned him around to their way of thinking. Well, they did. They were turning him around, And one could tell on various parades and things and working parties and that, if something happened and there was a bit of a schmozzle and a showdown, immediately the Korean sentry would mention the name of this chap, and he may or may not have been out on the working party, but this was the chap that they asked to deal with, rather than deal with all the other officers or anybody else who was there. No, they preferred to deal with this chap, so they knew who he was. But as for getting to the bottom of his mind, I couldn't. And of course, in the end, I didn't want to. The less I had to do with them, the better. And they were, as far as we were concerned, or whenever it was possible to do it, they were completely ostracized.
Did they get better treatment because of their cooperation?
No, absolutely not at all. And this is the puzzling thing about it. There was no way in which they could get it. This would have been an open thing. And there was no way in which the Japanese could have achieved this. No, they got no better treatment at all. But the point that I make is that in any of these situations, sadly, there will be collaborators.
Was there any element of any POWs accepting the political propaganda of the Japanese?
None whatsoever. We were completely and utterly united, and in the end, I suppose we were madly optimistic about the outcome. When you said earlier, were there any signs amongst the Japanese, of course, in the confines of a prison camp with absolutely no communication whatsoever, it's awfully difficult to see those signs, certainly at the time. But on looking back, perhaps there were one or two shifts that we ought to have noticed, that indicated that things were going better. But by and large, you know, the Japanese, like all Orientals, are fairly inscrutable.
What type of shifts do you have in mind?
Well, I have in mind perhaps very, very small things, and it had to be small things which affected our daily lives. I remember once we got some horrible toothpaste. And my recollection of this is when the Americans were sweeping towards the Philippines. I think that we got it about that time. And if it did connect at all, I mean, it is an indication that, you know, somebody was saying, well, we'll have to be more lenient with the prisoners. But what effect some sandy toothpaste would have had, I don't know. As far as we wanted something to eat, and everybody tried to eat the toothpaste, but it wasn't very good.
Were any of the POWs asked to make propaganda for the Japanese?
No, none whatsoever. They didn't do this. I believe they tried it on in Japan, where there were more sophisticated people. You've got to remember where we were. We were just a little labor camp stuck completely way off the map in North Korea. Just 200 or 300 of us, completely forgotten and left absolutely to the whims of the commandant and the guard. We never even saw the local commander or anybody at all. It was as simple as that as far as we were concerned.
You mentioned the cold in the winters. What type of clothing did you have at this time?
Oh, dear. Well, of course, the clothing that one had was just exactly what one could get. It was any British clothing that we'd brought up with us. And fortunately, most people had a pair of heavy trousers. But they gave us a Japanese coat and some loot towards the end. I remember I had a huge woolen scarf, which was made in Prawn in Australia by the Ladies' Society there. So this had obviously come through the Red Cross. I should think, but we had great big yellow coats, which overcoats issued by the Japanese, which were absolutely useless for warmth. But they made us wear them because of identification. But the point was that in the about October and that, you began to get anything at all that you could possibly stuff in your puttees or whatever you had around your legs or everything, and you just wore it from October until the following April, May. And cold, of course, was an awful factor there. And getting up at nights to go to the toilet was a terrible, terrible business, because you had to go out of the hut, out to the toilets and squat down. And I remember one night, and of course you had to bow to three sentries on the way there. And this delayed you, and was very, very cold, and made you colder. You probably got warm sleeping with all the rest of the chaps. But I remember one night going, and a little chap coming around and said, "Don't bow to him, sir, he's dead." And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Look at him." And he was frozen to death, this little Korean sentry. And that was the extent of the climate there. And they yanked him away the next morning, and he was. Of course, the pity was that there weren't a few more of them. But, however, you can gauge what the cold was in the hut, because all that we had was a little brickwork opening right bang in the middle of a huge barrack room containing, 120 people, I should think. And we had a little pine log about 3 or 4 feet long and about 8 inches thick per day to feed this stove with. Well, it generated a bit of heat, but they were wooden huts. They were damp and they were nasty. And you tried to generate as much fog as you possibly could, but you weren't allowed. The sentries were continually peering through the windows to make absolutely sure that there were no gatherings. And there was no need for any gatherings anyway. But the idea was to work up as much fog as you possibly could, empty your bowels, and make absolutely sure that you made as few visits as possible to the toilet. And there was no medicine, of course, absolutely no medicine whatsoever, not a sign of it. We never saw any medicine. We had a doctor there, who I believe is a surgeon down in Bristol now, the one in our camp, but poor chap, he had absolutely nothing whatsoever. There were no medical supplies of any description. And there was no way in which anything could be treated. We had chaps desperately ill towards the end with beriberi. And there was nothing that could be done about them. Of course, incredibly, they get very fat and bloated and that. And you had a lot of skinny people who were well and a lot of bloated and fat people who were very, very seriously ill. But medicine was one of the worries. You know, you did realize that if you were going to be ill, and of course this was the reason for the only escape that we ever had from that camp. And we had a lieutenant there, a young lieutenant who I knew well. He was a friend of mine, and the doc told him that he was going to die. I think it was consumption, I'm not sure, TB. That he would die anyway within 6 months, and he decided to go. And when he told me that he was going, I said, "Where the hell are you going? I mean, if you look on the map, where can you go? I mean, we're all long-nosed and Europeans." Anyway, he decided, incredible too, this, that he would go to Vladivostok. And I remember I got a map from him, a local map, which had a few railways and things on. We were doing a job in the in a big railway foundry factory, making casting molds for brake molds. And I managed to get one of the local railway maps there, and it was no good, really. It was no good to anybody. But anyway, it was something. And when we had our meal at night, the Japanese allowed us to scrape the boiler out, and each mess in turn got the burnt rice. And so when we knew that Joe was going, we decided to give him the burnt rice. Well, this could be saved, preserved. It was cold. It wouldn't go rotten. And he decided to go. He took with him a BQMS, who by this time was quite mental. this chap, poor chap. He was really mental, but obviously he wanted company, and if anybody had to go, well, this chap was as good as anybody else. And came the great day, and Joe went, and we never heard of him from that day to this. I was told later that he got about 50 yards or something, and they shot him. But they didn't let on, they didn't tell us. And they gave us hell, absolute hell, in the camp. One of the officers was removed. One of the Japanese officers was removed as a result of this. So, you know, for about 3 or 4 months after that, it was terrible, really, the discipline and the hotting up. But then I never heard and or never inquired. I was told at one of these FIPA meetings that he died, but if he's put down as died, well then, I mean, it could have been in any way, but I was told that he was shot by somebody. But certainly he didn't get very far, and there was no hope of anybody getting anywhere. So, I mean, escape was just something that you had to do at the very end. And, of course, as far as the end was concerned, when we knew it was coming, we tried to organize ourselves for this, that if we were going to be taken, that we'd take one Japanese with us anyway, and anybody could get hold of anything at all that was likely to help to in this situation, well, then they got hold of it, because by this time we'd been moved, of course, from Jinsen camp to Keijo, back to where all the original party was, and they were living under much better conditions than we'd lived, and although they put us in the bottom of this big warehouse, they'd been living by comparison with us rather well, so as far as we were concerned, it was a better camp. So to go back what you asked me about originally, was there a shift? Well, obviously there was a shift in their feeling then, because I understand that the whole of the camp in Jinsen was occupied by Americans in the end, and of course we had an American pilot who was shot down and brought into our camp, and it was pretty obvious that this was obvious all the way through, really, that if the Japanese were going to favor anybody at all, it would be the British as opposed to the Americans. And tacitly, I think that they had a tremendous respect for us, the Japanese, for British traditions and that. And I had a sneaking feeling all along the line that this mad commandant that we had, he would come out sometimes with utterances which I remember him once saying, completely out of the top of his head, I don't know whether he realized that he was saying, he said, British Royal Navy is very powerful and teach Japanese all their tricks. And it was this kind of thing. And there was he, a Japanese officer, an army officer, who seemed to give in absolutely to this the prestige of the Royal Navy. We didn't have any sailors in our camp, but I couldn't help feeling that they would have probably fared better than we did. There was a tremendous respect anyway for the British, but particularly for the Royal Navy. Absolutely incredible. And if you got chatting now and again to the Korean guards, obviously in their instruction somewhere, because they'd been instructed all the way up, because they wore uniform, you know, when they were cadets, when they were about 6 or 7 years of age in the schools, they'd been inculcated with this doctrine, I think, that the British Royal Navy was everything that, you know, any force could be.
How did you come to be released?
Well, We had a Russian Marine lieutenant come into the camp, and he was in a poor way. They treated him very badly. He'd been in a force which had come down from Vladivostok or something, and obviously the Russians were making skirmishes. And the American pilot came in, and I should never forget him. He told us of wondrous things that were going on outside, and how there was a bomb site now, which they could hit a tar barrel, a Sperry bomb site, I think he called it, could hit a tar barrel at 40,000 feet. And we had a feeling that things were getting very, very near, because incredibly, they took all our boots off us. They gathered in all the boots, and we had to go barefoot so that we wouldn't get out into Cajo, I suppose this was. We felt anyway they could have the boots, as if we were going to skate, we would skate better without the boots. We'd have to take the trouble of getting them off anyway, and we could get used to being in barefoot. It was rather funny, this bomb site business, because when the B-29s came up to drop the first supplies on us, they dropped them straight into them they came down, I know they'd come up right from Guam or somewhere, and they were absolutely at the limit of their flying, but nevertheless they were only about 400 feet, and they put the cargo right through the Japanese barracks, so they didn't hit any tar barrels at 40,000 feet. So much for the wonderful world outside. And the Japanese commandant just came in and said that the sensor was a wari, the war was over, and the Japanese were going to be friends with the Americans and the British, and that we'd be able to go home, and the whole world could live in peace afterwards, ever afterwards, or words to that effect. An incredible climb down. Of course, this was a new commandant, not our little madman that we knew down in Jinsen. But by and large, they conducted it very well, really, and this, I think, again, was possible because of the position that we were in. The Japanese, again, at that time, were more concerned. They wanted friends because they got a hell of a lot of enemies outside, and I think they were a damn sight more worried about the Koreans than they were about us.
Were the Koreans showing signs of restiveness?
I think, well, I've read that they were. They certainly never demonstrated to us, and for the whole of the time that we were PWs in Korea, the sad fact is that there was never any sign that they were going to there was going to be an uprising, or that there was going to be any cooperation or anything. They were just like sullen, mute animals. And anything that we ever thought of in terms of getting out, we never even thought of embracing, even sitting down amongst the whole of that Korean population and calling in any one of them, because quite honestly, there didn't seem to be any good reason to do so, or to expect any help from the population. They appeared to be so cowed. We do know now that they had a few underground organizations, but one can understand this because the extent of the Japanese occupation was so fearful, really. I mean, it was life and death if you were suspected or you took part in the slightest operation which was not in accordance with the usual custom, well then you gave your life. It was as simple as that.
Has your captivity left you with any permanent feelings towards the Japanese?
Yes, I disliked them. We had a feeling. I can't forgive them for lots of the things that they did to us. All right, they had the power of life and death over us. I don't think it was necessary that we should have been starved as we were, starved of everything, you know, of news, culture, or anything at all. We were completely starved, and had we stayed there much longer, we would have been like the Koreans. We had a saying in the camp, and I'm sure it's true today, that you scratch a Japanese and you've got a monkey. And this was the awful unpredictability of them the whole time in any situation that you got with them. You couldn't be absolutely certain which way the cat was going to jump with them. And in the end, even the best of them had this awful business, you know, taking the sword out and chopping your ruddy head off. I mean, there was always this picture of them in your own mind, that any one of them was capable of that. And I'm sure it's just as true today. I can't think that if you live with people for 3.5 years and you get this impression there you are, you've got somebody, if you just get him just sidetracked one little bit, that he's no longer a human being, well then I can't see how you can throw that off in the intervening years that they pretend that they have. And yet, of course, there's this tremendous dilemma of the other side of their character, of having so much respect for the Western culture.
Do you think that your captivity has left you with any long-term effects, either physical or mental or spiritual or attitude towards life or anything of that kind?
Spiritually, I wouldn't know. We were not allowed. They were anyone's own thoughts, innermost thoughts. We had a lay preacher there. On the deck that I lived, I don't think we turned to religion very much, sadly. I'd been exploring religions as a young single man in the Far East, and Zen Buddhism appealed to me at the time from what I'd read. And I can't help but feel that perhaps I missed something there. I don't know. But the effect, yes, I think the effect is a very long-term one, and a few years ago I wouldn't have admitted it. I think that it has a psychological effect on one, undoubtedly, ultimately, in the end. The one joy that I got out of it all, I think now is, and I've compared this with other PWs, we love to grow things, we love to produce things, to see things growing, to it's probably some antipathy towards the tremendous futileness, the destruction that one saw and that went on. And perhaps this inheritance has been left in one's mind of wanting to build things and create things rather than see them destroyed, because it was a terribly long, destructive period. And the way the Japanese cleared Korea, I mean, it's almost impossible to realize that it was cleared completely bare, and there was nothing at all there. And almost as soon as the thing lived, it was torn up and destroyed. And I think that one of the legacies is the fact that one wants to be productive, creative, rather than destructive. But to go back to the chaps that I've met, I was very lucky. I was single. I hadn't got family ties as some of them had got. I'd been in the Far East. I knew the Japanese. I think I was terribly lucky. But yes, I don't want to confess, really, but I do think it must leave its mark eventually on one.